Morning, everyone. Thank you, Bells. First things first, yes, something's a little different. No, I didn't forget. And yes, I'll probably do this for a few weeks, at least over the summer. Second thing, I have to exonerate my wife's good name. The last time I was up here to share with you, you remember I told that story about a certain glass bowl exploding? Well, I got to lunch following the FLC service that day. We had the lunch with the staff of the newcomers. And I sit down with my family at the table, and Danielle looked at me, smiled. She said, "I'm not mad, I'm just curious. Is that really how you remember that story going?" It was. I wasn't lying or anything. It turns out she was completely uninvolved. We had actually had something stored in that bowl, and I had asked her, "Do you want me to go ahead and reheat it?" And she said, "Yes," assuming I would use, you know, the microwave, not the stovetop. And so that was all on me, not her. Love my wife. I'm grateful for her patience with me, her grace, and her common sense. So, third thing, just to let you know, there are no slides today. Caitlin, God bless her, had them all ready. They were good to go. And as of Friday, about 4:45, the computer crashed and took them all away. I said, "Don't worry about it." All right, so I will try to guide us through without the slides on the screen behind me today. We're going to be in Judges chapter 1. A few weeks ago, if you remember, we had covered chapter 3 of Judges, Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. And at that time, I had said that it could serve as a standalone message, but that there was also this really helpful background information to that story earlier in the book of Judges, and that I had hoped we'd get to it in the next couple of weeks. Today is that day. We're going to be in Judges chapter 1. I hope over the course of the next several months, on and off, to work us through the book of Judges as a whole. Today, as we go through the opening chapter, we're calling it Big Toes, Little Sins, and the Sovereign Grace of God. Big toes, little sins, God's sovereign grace. You'll see where big toes comes from. And you can, today I think is a day where you'll be glad we don't just always go with, you know, the first image that comes to mind for the bulletin graphic. But so here's the opening to the book of Judges, Judges chapter 1. After the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, "Who will be the first to go up and fight for us against the Canaanites?" The Lord answered, "Judah is to go. I've given the land into their hands." Then the men of Judah said to the Simeonites, their brothers, "Come up with us into the territory allotted to us to fight against the Canaanites. We, in turn, will go with you into yours." So the Simeonites went with them. When Judah attacked, the Lord gave. The Lord gave the Canaanites and Perizzites into their hands, and they struck down 10,000 men at Bezek. It was there that they found Adonai Bezek and fought against him, putting to rout the Canaanites and Perizzites. Adonai Bezek fled, but they chased him and caught him and cut off his thumbs and big toes. Then Adonai Bezek said, 70 kings with their thumbs and big toes cut off have picked up scraps under my table. Now God has paid me back for what I did to them." They brought him to Jerusalem, and he died there. The men of Judah attacked Jerusalem also and took it. They put the city to the sword and set it on fire. After that, the men of Judah went down to fight against the Canaanites living in the hill country, the Negev, and the western foothills. They advanced against the Canaanites living in Hebron, formerly called Kiriath Arba, and defeated Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai. From there, they advanced against the people living in Debir, formerly called Kiriath Sefer. And Caleb said, "I will give my daughter Aksah in marriage to the man who attacks and captures Kiriath Sefer." Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, took it. So Caleb gave his daughter Aksah to him in marriage. One day when she came to Othniel, she urged him to ask her father for a field. When she got off her donkey, Caleb asked her, "What can I do for you?" She replied, "Do me a special favor. Since you've given me land in the Negev, give me also springs of water." Then Caleb gave her the upper and lower springs. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the Kenite, went up from the city of Palms with the men of Judah to live among the people of the desert of Judah in the Negev near Arad. Then the men of Judah went with the Simeonites, their brothers, and attacked the Canaanites living in Zephath, and they totally destroyed the city. Therefore, it was called Hormah, which means destruction. The men of Judah also took Gaza, Ashkelon, and Ekron, those Philistine cities, each city with its territory. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from it the three sons of Anak, Sheshai, Ahiman, and Talmai, as mentioned earlier. The Benjamites, however, failed to dislodge the Jebusites, who were living in Jerusalem. To this day, the Jebusites live there with the Benjamites. Showing us this was likely written just before the time of King David's victory, because the Jebusites were still there. Now, the house of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them. When they sent men to spy out Bethel, formerly called Luz, the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well." So he showed them, and they put the city to the sword, but spared the man and his whole family. He then went to the land of the Hittites, where he built a city and called it Luz, which is its name to this day. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan or Tanakh or Dor or Ibleam or Megiddo and their surrounding settlements. For the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalal, who remained among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Akko or Sidon or Alab or Aksib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. You think it's hard to listen to that? It's hard to say it. And because of this, the people of Asher lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemeth or Beth Anath. But the Naphtalites, too, lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land. And those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites, the tribe of Israel, the tribe of Dan. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, not allowing them to come down into the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heres, Ajalon, and Shaalbim. But when the power of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from Scorpion Pass to Selah and beyond. The word of the Lord. So often I think what happens for us when we read that chapter or passages like it is the Israelites went to this town and then they went to that town. And none of the names mean anything to me, and I certainly don't know where they are, so chapter 2, right? Sort of when you get on the ride at the amusement park at Hershey Park. You don't get anything. So often I think that's what happens for us when we read stuff like this. The opening to an utterly fascinating, colorful book comes across as utterly underwhelming to us. So I want to try to help us with that today. And I want to do that not by having looked up every one of the names and giving you this, you know, original meaning that will unlock the secret to the passage if we only could speak Hebrew. Not that at all. I want to do it. I want to help that problem simply by pointing out this general pattern through the chapter. Today, just for today, almost regardless of the names themselves, just the general pattern. So the first thing I want to show you, the first thing that Judges 1 shows us is, first, the depravity of man. The depravity of man. It's okay if you spell it wrong in your bulletin. I know you'd get it right if it was on the screen behind me. Depravity is just this other word for sinfulness. Our inability, our unwillingness to do that which God has called us to do. Look at the depravity, look at the disobedience of God's own people in this text. The book of Judges covers the settlement of the land, covers the period from the death of Joshua, Moses' successor, covers the period from his death all the way to the time of the monarchy, the time of the kings. It's a period of about 180 years. Joshua, as Moses' successor, was the one who led the people into the promise, into the land. That means when we read Judges, the people are already in. The people are in the land of promise that God had for them. So they're in the land, they're in it, but Joshua has died. Their leader is no more with them. And Judges opens with this summary, this overview of where each tribe went and what they did getting their inheritance. And look at the pattern. Look what happens. Judah goes first. They're largely successful. But there's just this one area where their obedience is not complete. Verse 19, they take possession of the hill country, but they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had iron chariots. You know, it's God Almighty, iron chariots, can't do it. And so Judah's action or failure to act is framed not in terms of greater military strength, but actually in terms of obedience. It's not a question of what technology they have, it's a question of you have God on your side. And so they're largely successful, there's just this one area where they disobey and don't take what they were supposed to. It's a downward spiral from there. The Canaanites end up living alongside Judah. From there, verse 21, the Benjamites fail to dislodge the Jebusites. And so to this day, to that day, the Jebusites and Benjamites live alongside one another. All right? Canaanites live alongside Judah. Benjamin and Jebusites live alongside one another. And then you get into this rash of tribes who do this whole forced labor thing. Right, verses 27 through 34, all of these different tribes, the idea seems to be that when they go in, they don't have the strength, or they think they don't have the strength. Remember, they have God Almighty on their side. But they think they don't have the strength. So they don't take over everything at once. And then the narrator tells us when they do become strong, and the hope, the expectation would be when they become strong, then they get rid of those who are not supposed to be there. But that's not what they do. When they become strong, they press the Canaanites into forced labor. What are they saying? They're saying, we can control you. We can keep you around. We can compromise. We can tolerate you. We can do this and still be who God has called us to be. We can control you under our thumb. And by the time you get to verse 32, with the tribe of Asher, perhaps a key switch in the chapter, we are told the people of Asher live among the Canaanites. Who's the ruling party? Now it's no longer people of God, a few Canaanites there, but actually now Asher is just fortunate to live alongside the Canaanites. Until finally you hit rock bottom with the tribe of Dan. The Amorites totally confine them to the hill country. It's a downward spiral. It's a downward spiral. It starts off mostly victory, just one area of compromise, and then it gets worse and worse, and finally you get to where the thing you compromise with is actually totally controlling you, totally restraining you. What starts with just a little deviation ends up with you being totally controlled by the thing you thought you could keep under wraps. And the narrator of Judges is deliberately presenting it to us in this order to reinforce that truth. Now, I would venture to say that you and I know how this works. In the last year, I have had occasion to throw out and burn two novels. I was given two novels at a yard sale. I didn't even try it. You sort of show interest, and they're ready to get rid of all their stuff. Like, just take it. Like, no, I really wasn't trying to barter, but go to this yard sale. I get given two novels. Most of the reading that I do is nonfiction. Right? It's informational. It's devotional. It's related to this process right here. But every once in a while, I enjoy reading fiction. A spy thriller, a novel, something along those lines. Usually has to do with summer, the beach, vacation. And so last summer, we go to the beach and I start reading this one novel. I didn't know anything about it except I had recognized the title. I start reading it and Danielle looks at it and she says, "I'm surprised you're reading that. Isn't that full of like really twisted stuff? Really perverted stuff?" Spoiler alert, if you ever have this conversation with your wife, listen to her. I said, I don't think so. I really don't think that's where this is headed. It was a few pages in, so I kept going. It took me until a half of the way through the book till I came across something so disgusting. I ran out of the house, down in the backyard, threw it in the burn barrel, and set it on fire. I don't want anybody to come across this in my house. You know why it took me till halfway through the book to do that? Because it started small. It started subtle, gradual. Just this little blip and then you get on with the story. It wasn't that bad. Slowly and slowly until eventually you get to something so awful, just get it out. That was the first one. The second one, and you might say, I should have known better, but different author and even completely different genre. All right, so I have this second book. I start reading it just recently, this massive 1,000-page spy thriller. I'm 60 pages into it. You know the same thing started happening? Just this little blip on the radar. It's not that bad. And truly, this one may even was never going to get that bad. I don't know. But I had a dream one night. I'm not going to tell you the details of the dream today. I might next week. We'll see. I had a dream one night. And out of that dream, I awoke with one of those surges of adrenaline, drenched in sweat, saying, Jesus is Lord, and what in my life least lines up with me saying, Jesus is Lord? And immediately my mind goes to the bedstand where this book is laying. And I knew I got to get rid of it. It's not that bad. It doesn't help with me saying, Jesus is Lord. And I knew I got to do it right away, because if I wait till daytime, if I wait till when I wake up, my mind is going to come up with all of these justifications, all of these rationalizations. It's just par for the course for secular books, right? It's just part of the story. It's just a little bit. It's not that bad. I can control it. Do you see the downward spiral? It starts off small, and it reels you. You know how this works, don't you? We see this. There are a few people who get into affairs trying it. There are a few people who go out seeking adultery. But many, many more never intend anything that bad. It starts with a look. It starts with a look. And then we entertain the thought. And then we'll just reach out and have a little bit of communication, a little bit of messaging back and forth, a little bit of verbal contact, and it builds and builds and goes from it. You get trapped. Judges chapter 1 is showing us the downward spiral. If we are going to go to God, give Him everything, don't compromise. Don't let anything in your life and say, this I can handle, this is not that awful. Downward spiral. The thing most likely to keep us, the thing most likely to keep you, and I'm going to give you a couple of caveats first. The caveats of saying, I don't know your past. I don't know your general situation, your personal history, your personal temptations. This is a generalization or a stereotype for all of us. Those are the caveats. Now, with all of the rhetorical force I can muster, the thing that is going to most keep you from God's best for you is not some atrocious, horrible evil, but close enough and settling with that. Thinking you're close enough already and being content with that. Just a little time on this activity. Just a little priority given here. You can be a Christian and do that. These two things can live alongside one another. The thing that's going to keep you from God's best for you is good enough. Clean the house. Get it out. Clean the house. The depravity of man. They're in the land, and even once you're in the land of promise, the inability, the unwillingness to go all the way for the Lord. It's true of the Israelites, God's own people. It's also true, naturally enough, of the Canaanites. Judges chapter 1 contains the story of Adonai Bezek. This Canaanite king, this source for the big toe imagery for us today. Adonai Bezek, upon whom the Israelites inflict this rather weird punishment of cutting off thumbs and big toes. And I think you can tell how empathetic of a person you are by how much this little line right here begins to tingle as we talk about cutting off thumbs or down in your toes. You can tell how readily you empathize with what's going on for somebody else's situation. Either that, or you can tell how much of a hypochondriac you are, like, it's happening to me. There's a tingling when we think about this. Now, if the punishment seems strange, why would they go for the thumbs and the big toes? It helps to know that it was a common enough punishment that conquerors meted out in those days, as Adonai Bezek's own words indicate. I did this to 70 others, he says. Why were they going around doing this so often? You know, in the thumb lies the ability to grip a sword, right? To grip a sword. In the thumb lies your ability to fight back, to defend yourself. You cut off somebody's thumb, they're never picking up a sword against you again. You remove their ability to fight back against you in the future. Big toe, the big toe is necessary, vital, of course, for balance. So possibly that, you know, balance for fighting back in battle. But also the big toe is pretty important for, you know, running, getting away. And so if you remove your enemy's big toes, you remove their ability to get away from you, to escape. And so actually in these verses, thumbs and big toes, in these verses we have the classic fight or flight response to conflict. When you face an enemy, you're going to either fight back or you're going to flee. You're going to get away. Adonai Bezek did it to many others. Now they're doing it to him. Removing their ability to defend yourself, removing your ability to escape. But the thing that I want to bring out for us is so often we have this idea God is loving in the New Testament and he's only wrath in the Old Testament. And how could a loving God possibly condemn all of those Canaanites to death? And the fuller explanation, the fuller treatment of that dilemma, that wrestling match, we'll have to do later on. The thing I want to point out for us today is the Canaanites themselves don't have that problem. God wipes out the Canaanites. He punishes Adonai Bezek. And you notice Adonai Bezek doesn't say, well, that's not fair. He doesn't say, why didn't you give me more of a chance? If only I had more revelation. God punishes Adonai Bezek and he says, getting what I deserved. He knows he deserved it. He has a higher view of God's justice and his own wickedness than many of us do. The depravity of man. Adonai Bezek pronounces his own sentence. He knows he deserves everything he's getting, and it's true of the Israelites as well as the Canaanites. They as well do not do what God has called them to do, depravity. So if that's the case, how in the world is it 8:58 already? Okay. That's number one. Number two, the sovereignty of God. We're going to do this in bullet point form. I have five lessons on the sovereignty of God, believe it or not. Here they are very quickly. If it's the case that everybody is deserving of judgment, then what in the world is God up to in the story? Is he just going to wipe everybody out? No. Through all of these people who deserve nothing from him, look at the gracious purposes. His purposes of grace and redemption and salvation, he is working through all of these sinful vessels. The first lesson of his sovereignty is, look at verse 3. Verse 2 and 3. God said, I've given the land into Judah's hands. Notice Judah says in response to that, Simeon, why don't you go up with us? Why don't you work together with us? God has already told them, I've given it into your hands. Notice their response is to rest on that, just saying, well, it doesn't matter what we do, it's just going to happen. No, their response rightly to God's promise is, come with us, we need to work together. The only area of major, by and large, victory in the chapter is when God's people work together. God's sovereignty works through Christian community. There's no rule that each one had to take what was given to them on their own, work together. Part of his sovereignty. Second lesson, verse 4. A principle that appears throughout the Bible. When Judah attacked, the Lord gave. Just like with the community, knowing what God was going to do does not lead Judah to say, it doesn't matter then, let's just wait for him to do it. Knowing what God said he's going to do actually leads them to action, and it's as they act, as they step out, he brings about the victory he promised to give. God's sovereignty through human action, through human agents. That's the second lesson. Here's the third. Judges chapter 1 sprinkles in these three little vignettes of individuals. Adoni-Bezek, Othniel and Aksa, and then this man from Luz, which we'll get to in just a minute. And through these three little vignettes, Judges is showing us that this God, who is sovereign over the affairs of tribes and nations, is also absolutely sovereign over every single individual caught up in the account, caught up in the affair. As he works out his purposes with the Canaanites and Perizzites and so many others, it's not that there's collateral damage, like, oh, whoops, sorry, you happen to be a part of them. No, through giving us the vignettes of the individuals, Judges is showing us he's sovereign over the individual heart. Every individual life, you can trust him. Now, fourth, that little vignette from Luz. In the first place, this man, with its overtones, its echoes of Rahab, if you remember back in Joshua, it sounds very similar to what happened with the spies in Rahab. In doing so, this man shows us that the Israelite purpose was not ultimately the destruction of all the people, but their salvation. Israel was to be a vessel of salvation. And so those who come, who join sides with Israel, will experience that from the Lord. Yet simultaneously, and perhaps even more so, the key difference between this man and Rahab is while she joins the covenant community, it's what is affirmed in Matthew 1 in the New Testament with the genealogy, she becomes part of them. What does this man do? He goes and he rebuilds everything that they just tried to destroy. And so this man shows us why the Lord called them to the destruction of these pagan peoples. To preserve the purity of worship in this nation. Any who would remain would recreate this false worship, this system of pagan idolatry and false gods. And so for the purity of God's people, you got to get rid of it. Get it out. That's why this section applies so much more to the church today than to any nation, political nation on earth. It's about the purity of worship. If we do not get rid of every little thing that remains that taints and stains, it will stick around and fester and reproduce what we left. The sovereign purposes of God. So what is he calling you to do? And who is he calling you to do it with? And how can you and I be a community that's part of an upward spiral of obedience and victory and promise and not a downward spiral of disobedience and temptation? How can that happen? Three, the mortality of Joshua. First, the depravity of man. Second, the sovereignty of God. Third, the mortality of Joshua after the death of Joshua. At the time of the death of Joshua, verse 1, after the death of Joshua, the Israelites asked the Lord, who will be the first to go up for us? The death of Joshua. And God says, Judah is to go first. The narrator of Judges is deliberately framing all of these events in terms of the death, the mortality of Yeshua. Joshua was the great successor to Moses, who would lead his people into the promise. What's interesting is the middle of chapter 2, verses 6 through 9, recounts Joshua's passing in more detail, as we may see in the next couple of weeks. Judges is covering the time span of Joshua, his death, until the reign of the king, the living king. And so at one level, Judges is saying this is what happens when you do not have a godly leader leading you. It's anarchy. Yet even more, the name Joshua, of course, means the Lord saves. The Lord saves. From the Lord is salvation. And in Hebrew and Aramaic and Greek, there is an equivalence between the names Joshua, Yeshua, Jesus. One from Judah who would go first and lead the way to bring his people into the promise. It would be the way. Now, what did Adonai Bezek say? What did the king say? You remember? My thumbs, my hands, my feet cut off, and I'm only getting what I deserve. He's saying what we all deserved, Israelite, Canaanite, pagan, Christian, what we deserve on our own. So how can we, if we deserve judgment, get the promise? You need the death of a Yeshua. A Yeshua who would say, bring down the judgment on my hand and on this hand and on my feet. And remove from me, I give up my ability, my right to defend myself, grasp the sword, to defend myself, to fight back. What did Yeshua say? I could have called down a legion of angels to defend me. He doesn't do it. He's giving up his right to defend himself, to fight back. A Yeshua who said, I will give up my right to flee, to escape, to get away what's coming me. What were all the temptations of Satan to Jesus in the desert? To escape the cross, to get away from the cross. And Jesus says, no, I'm not going to do that. Pin down my arms. Pin down my feet. Cut me off. Put on me the judgment they deserved so that you might give them the promise, the community that I deserved. He clothed himself with mortality. Philippians chapter 2, he put on himself mortality, human flesh, human death, so that he might clothe you and me with immortality, 1 Corinthians 15. So that the mortal might be caught up in the immortal. It took his death to bring you in. And after that first Joshua died, the people returned to their old ways. So what you really need is not just a Joshua who would die for you, but also a Joshua who would live for you, who would lead you. It's exactly what you have. A Yeshua who would die and come back to life, that he might ever live for and lead his people in the promise. Jesus Christ said, give me what I don't deserve so you could give them what they don't deserve. When you experience that, oh, it has to change the way we think fight or flight is our only response to conflict. You can look at him and see you can stay and take it on yourself, even if you don't deserve it, for redemptive suffering, to create community and relationship with the person who is wronging you. It removes fight or flight as the only two possibilities. What we needed was a Joshua who would never die, or better, a Joshua who would die and then come back to life with death no longer having power over him. Salvation from an impure people, the line of Israel, the tribe of Judah, the first to go up into the promise. Because he looked at you and said, I'll take what you deserve. You can look at him and get what he deserves. That's what we're going to do with our closing song. Real growth, real change comes not from trying harder, but from beholding what he has done. So look at him, contemplate his death, his resurrection, and receive the grace of God as we give him everything. Would you pray with me? Father, indeed, we do pray again for our president. As your word commands us to pray for our leaders. We pray that this nation would mercifully be removed from the downward spiral and set back on a path to you, set on a path to you. Pray that this nation, that President Trump would be characterized evermore by selfless service and your new life. I pray that there would be such a demeanor and a character oozing out of this man that it would be undeniable to all he has met Jesus Christ. We pray for your church, that we would be a church of pure, unadulterated worship. Give us the self-examination to look into our lives and see anything that does not belong, anything that does not submit to your glory, your lordship. And give us the boldness, the desire to cast it off, that we might live in the covenant, the promise, the beauty of walking with you. Praise you for your death and resurrection. Lead us, our living Lord. Amen.